Hello, poetry lovers. Welcome to the Poetry Hood podcast. It has been my absolute honor to record this wonderful conversation with Carlos Andres Gomez, who is a poet that is filled with insights, experience, and just radiates with love and kindness. He recently published his beautiful poetry book, which I highly recommend, titled Hijito, which is available on Noon.com as well as Amazon. Special thanks and shout out to Emirates Airline Festival of Literature for inviting the Poetry Hood to be a part of their outstanding festival that they've set up in 2020, and for facilitating this podcast recording. Poetry lovers, I present to you my conversation with Carlos.
My entire wardrobe was Canal Street original. Knock off chic, adolescent sleek in my double XL blue and black bubble jacket. Yeah, I was inside the club, and what? Inside an oversized coat, coated in sweat and Old Spice, a kid eyeing 16 but not quite there, I wanted it all, Chico. Learner's permit, the latest Jordans in baby blue, maybe a wink from the pretty Boricua in social studies. And when Biggie's verse dropped in Only You, he was in that room and teaching us how to live elevated from that third floor wasteland towering above India Point. So we sang, sour throated and nostalgic for times we hadn't yet lived in unison like we wrote it. Till our voices cracked and spilled over and between every rift, but in the throng of lost kids where I finally found a self I loved, it all came together like we could remix any wreckage and make it into a stage to slay. So we swayed and grinded like our lives were a music video tribute, hip to hip.
I'm actually very honored that you reached out to me and told me, let's do this podcast.
No, I'm honored. I'm inspired by what you've built here in Dubai. You know, I came up as a poet in community, you know? And so I think when I travel abroad and I have the incredible opportunity to do a festival like this, I want to connect with other communities that are happening. You know, I've always thought about poetry as not a solitary endeavor. I understand that there are times we're writing by ourselves, but I've always thought about it as something that is processed in community with other writers. So that's my favorite part of what this is, and that's why I was excited to have an opportunity to chat with you.
This is the first time where this has happened, where someone reached out to me, told me, I want to be on your podcast. Usually I'm begging people, come on, please. But yeah, really appreciate that.
My pleasure.
I wanted to start off by mentioning something. So I read your book, Hijito,
yeah. Uh-huh.
And there's a poem that really spoke to me.
Sure.
It's called Pronounced.
Yes, yes.
And if you don't mind, I'd like to read like two stanzas
Absolutely.
From that poem.
Absolutely.
That really hit home. It goes, you are still trying to retrieve the sounds you once dreamt in. You hardly remember your mother, tongue. You are trying to pull something usable from the wreckage, yet it all feels familiar. Your best friend compliments your clean pronunciation, the way you have learned to let go of everything you once called home. I love it. It's so like it spoke to me to be honest, my mother tongue is Arabic, and at some point during my life I kind of started losing it, and English was creeping in for whatever reasons, and I find myself currently now in a state of like trying to salvage my Arabic language from the wreckage. I was wondering, what is your story with your mother tongue?
Oh my gosh. I'm so moved and honored that it spoke to you in that way. I mean, that's the hope with any poem. I think that writing something that's so highly personal oftentimes does resonate with something that's universal, mm-hmm. and that can speak across time and space and language and experience. So for me, English is actually my third language.
Third.
And yet my dominant language. and yet the language that I mostly operate in now. Mm. So my first languages were Portuguese and Spanish. I lived in Brazil when I was very little, and I've forgotten all of my Portuguese, and I forgot a lot of my Spanish, got a lot of it back, lost it, got a bunch back. Wow. It's still in process. And I think part of that was, in my context, was my father arrived in the United States as an immigrant from Colombia when he was 13 years old in 1961. He didn't speak a word of English. In that era, his parents just threw him in a school and said, go figure it out. And everyone spoke English. And of course, he failed all the classes because he didn't speak the language. And, you know, and so I think...
That's so unheard of. Like, imagine that happening today.
Oh my gosh. No, I know. But I think that whether it was conscious or subconscious, I think that when I was operating and playing with my sister and we were speaking Portuguese, or I was thinking in Spanish or whatever it was, I think there was a part of my father that, whether consciously or subconsciously, panicked and feared that I would experience what he went through, feeling alienated because he did not speak English, or feeling othered, or feeling or being disparaged, or being excluded. And so I remember getting to a point when I was 5 years old and they said, only English. Mm. We only speak English. And that's when I started to lose those two other languages. And so it's I have a very complicated, loaded relationship to language generally. And it's one of those things people say, oh yeah, so what's your dominant language, or what do you speak Spanish? And it's, you know, my Spanish is a lot better than I lead on, mm-hmm. but I have a very complicated relationship with it because of that. And this is a great, that poem is capturing, actually, that was a real thing that my best friend in fifth grade when I was 10 years old said to me. And it was like a sword that he thought was a compliment,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
And it was something that was sort of highlighting this profound grief and loss that I felt, that he saw as something that was a positive. And I think that's something that a lot of children of immigrants can relate to, or a lot of people who live in sort of multicultural, fractured, culturally displaced or misplaced upbringings, I think, and beyond, obviously. But yeah, I think it's something that I've had a lot of people who've read that poem or who've heard that poem have approached me about, and they've said, oh my gosh, that's my experience with, you know, Tagalog or Cantonese or, you know, Arabic. So yeah, that means a lot.
Yeah, beautiful. I also was wondering, like, since it probably hits home with a lot of people, whenever you're sitting down and writing poetry, do you ever think of how far and wide your poem is going to reach?
Wow.
Where, like, just like in my case, halfway around the world?
I mean, you know, no. I think if I thought about that, I think it would probably stop the process. I mean, you never know. I mean, it's also counterintuitive. You know, there are poems that you think no one will see, and that becomes the poem that resonates with people everywhere, and vice versa. So I think for me, I always start with, you know, maybe it's like a single image or a single picture or a single exchange, or maybe a word or a concept. And I kind of slowly sort of interrogate that and build out from there. But I have clear ideas in different poems about who I'm speaking to or what I'm holding up to the light. But I'm never thinking, okay, I hope this, or I'm planning for this poem to have 2 million people read it or whatever. I think I'm always starting with something small that I'm looking at very closely and then holding up to the light. And to me, I think that's counterintuitively or paradoxically the way that I think my poems often have the most profound and universal resonance, is when I look at something very specifically or in a way that's highly personal. I think those are the poems that paradoxically are the ones that people deeply resonate with, and they'll say, oh my gosh, I'm not Colombian or Latino or speak Spanish, but I'm Yemeni and I feel the same way about that. You know?
Yeah, totally. I even thought of that when you had multiple accounts of gunshots in your poetry book, and you know, like, gunshots is not a big thing in our region.
You never
hear of it, but it's still like, it thunders through your poems and you can relate to it.
Yeah, absolutely. The first time I got pulled over, I turned to the classical station. made sure to elevate my voice an octave, blinked wide and scared, rested shaking hands on the steering wheel so he could see the white of my eyes and emerald irises in the late May sun. He didn't ask my name, never saw license or registration, said just take it easy. So I did. So I do. But my son, now 14 years and 4 months from his first driver's test, is black. What will he do? How much of my stare and smart mouth are imprinted? How will he understand why I can't sleep each night he's away from home and I look just like the men who too easily mistake the dark silhouette of his wallet for a gun?
Is there a story
behind
how you got into poetry?
Yes, there actually is. So when I was 17 years old, I hid it from almost everyone. It was hidden from almost everyone I knew besides my best friend and my girlfriend at the time. But I'd been writing poems for 6 months and having a little bit of an identity crisis about it because I'd been a basketball player up to that point in my life. I didn't think of myself as an artist or a writer. And this great poet by the name of Martín Espada came to my high school and read from his book, Imagine the Angels of Bread. And it was the first time I heard a poet that felt like he was reading pages out of a journal I had buried in my chest. Mm-hmm. And I'd never been so moved. And after that day and after that performance, I recognized that I could not live without poetry. And I think it became a way for me to survive a very difficult time in my life. And after that performance, I walked up to Martin and bought a copy of his book. And he looked at me. I could barely eke out my name. And he took the book and he wrote, "Para Carlos, Poeta del Futuro Martín Espada," which means "For Carlos, Poet of the Future." And he ultimately gave me permission to embrace my identity as a poet and as a writer. And coming full circle nearly 20 years later, he's the person who wrote the introduction to Hijito. So it's been incredible to think about that journey and things coming full circle. He's someone who I had the opportunity to do some readings with and sort of kept in touch with over the years and been a kind of mentor in some ways. And I think who I am today as a writer in many ways has been made possible by Martín Espada, by others. But I think if I was to pick one person and say this person is the main reason I'm a writer, I would have to say Martín Espada.
Amazing. Shout out to Martinez.
Shout out to Martin.
I do share a somewhat similar thing is that I went under a pseudonym for a while.
Yes, yes.
And it was one of the corniest pseudonyms you could ever think of.
I love it.
It was called Pondering Thoughts.
Yes, okay. I love it. I love it. Yes.
And, you know, like for me, it was after like a year maybe or two.
Sure.
I was just sitting at home and I had an job as an auditor I was just like, I didn't like where I was in life, and I just thought to myself, I just want to take one step towards the right direction, just one.
Yes.
I just sat there thinking and I looked at these set of poems that I had. I told myself, why am I so shy from saying that this is me?
Oh,
this is
yes.
so annoying.
Wow, that's profound. Yeah.
I'm caged in.
Yeah.
So I came up with the idea of, let me create a cool platform for me to share my poetry and maybe solve the same problem for many other people.
And I love that. And that was the birth of the Poetryhood.
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. I love that.
Right there and then I bought the website.
Oh,
and
I love
that. So on and so forth. And now we're here.
I love that. Brilliant. Brilliant.
This is a question I ask a lot of people,
sure.
poets and sure. poetry lovers, and I get different answers
okay.
all the time. Do you think a poet is born a poet, or do you think the environment nurtures him to become a poet?
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's a great question. I don't know what the answer to that is. I mean, I'll say for me, I think I was made a poet by the circumstances of my childhood. I lived in 4 countries. I juggled 7, 8 different languages. I went to 12 different schools before I graduated high school. And so most of my childhood was spent as an outsider, as kind of a culturally displaced kid, as somebody who knew what it was like to come home at the end of a school day and have no friends. And I think that instilled in me this, I think, comfort with both being by myself, but also being somebody who watched and observed, and also complicated my perceptions of those around me. Because I think I didn't have the luxury of being somebody who belonged socially and being able to sort of cast people aside. I think I had to sort of challenge my assumptions and be more open to, I don't know, I guess embracing the very dimensions of the people around me, because I wasn't somebody who had a lot of like social leverage until later in my life and later in my schooling. But yeah, I think just watching and listening really carefully. There's nothing like being left out or being an outsider that will force you to find creative ways to fill that time and that space. And even the grief that comes along with being on the outside. And so I think for me, the way that I guess built meaning out of feeling on the outside was I watched people and I noticed the small little moments and the little glimpses of things that were easy to overlook, or that often other people would not catch. But me, because I didn't have a lot of things distracting me or pulling me away, I could just watch this person by themselves, you know, pushing that apple across the table in the cafeteria to that other kid, you know? So I think I'll just say in my case, I can't speak for everybody else. I'm not everybody else, but I speak for me. Maybe there was a poet always in there meant to come out. Maybe it wouldn't have come out if I didn't have my childhood, but my childhood definitely demanded that I develop the eye that I think as a watcher and as an observer that I know for my own artistic practice is vital. Yeah. And you see it now. So much of my work is autobiographically at least oriented in some way, at least as a springboard. And many of them are just personal narratives that are told through a poem. So you definitely see that, I think, play out in a lot of my work, particularly the last few years.
Yeah, I like the awareness that you have in how you came up to this point.
It's
really, really insightful, actually. Yeah.
Thank you.
It's opening my mind to some things of how maybe I got here. So I just watched you perform tonight.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Performance.
Thank you.
Do you see yourself performing a ritual inside your head before you go on stage? Or is it just Carlos the entire time?
Wow, that's a great question. I think just because of how many readings I've done, just the amount of repetitions and it being thousands upon thousands at this point, I think in a lot of those scenarios, I used to have rituals to prepare, but I think that was disrupted so many times, as is often the case when people do things thousands of times, that I sort of let go of those rituals. I think if there's any ritual, I think that there's kind of an immense stillness that I become rooted in my body, in my literal and figurative body when I get up in front of an audience. And I don't know, for me, I think the process of performing is kind of like meditative play and just being intensely present and trying to authentically and genuinely live in my body and be open to this moment of connecting with the people in front of me. So, yeah, I guess that's the only ritual I can think, is just being rooted in an epic stillness that I find extremely replenishing and also just enthralling.
I really like that phrase, epic stillness. It really does describe the moment that you step on stage, because there's just this silence and everyone's just like, all right, come on, we're waiting for you. And you're like, you guys have no idea what I got in store for you.
I love it.
I've learned a lot, to be honest, during my very small career in performance. Of course,
yeah, every moment is a learning experience.
Yes,
you know, every repetition, every time up there. Yeah,
absolutely. And the poem that you might have performed like already three times or four, five, six,
sure
is changing and evolving.
Yeah, it's never the same. Absolutely.
And I think that's very important to not stay rigid on how your poem is going to be performed.
I never do that. I always say one of the most important things for me is I never replicate anything. Everything I do is the first and last time I will do it. Mm-hmm. And I think a good sign of that is I love when I've done a poem that I've done many times and someone will say, who knows me and knows my work, will say, wow, what's that poem called? I've never heard that poem before. And I'll say, you've heard that poem about five times. But that's brilliant that you don't believe that you've heard it, yeah. Which means that it was so new and so fresh that it almost took on a life of its own as though it was a new poem. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the magic of just being present. And also I try to listen to my own, listen to the moments that are kind of, that are just kind of emerging as I'm going along in a piece. And sometimes, you know, in the great moments, I'll surprise myself or something will happen in the space that'll change the trajectory of what I thought I was going to do. Morning, Rikers Island. Physics and light pierce the hollow stench of the forgotten gymnasium stripped naked of clocks. All the adolescent boys stop, offer their grief to each other like water, glancing out the only window they all share. A single ray unfolds its warmth across the dusty belly of the thudded parquet. And here's the miracle. The sun frees everyone to sing.
Which book have you gifted the most?
That gifted the most, yeah, to people. Oh my gosh. Wow. Well, that's a great question. I'm trying to think of the books that I've gifted the most. I think one of them is definitely my favorite novel of all time, which is by my favorite writer of all time, The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. There's something about that novel that, resonates so profoundly with me. And also I think in so many different ways, it's such an invitation towards humanity and resilience and dismantling the toxic and horrific systems and paradigms of thinking that I think try to terrorize our own sense of self-worth. And obviously the poem centers black girls and black women, as so much of Toni Morrison's work does. But you know, it's really profound that a book that does that, I also feel, speaks very much to my experience in different ways, although I'll never know what it's like obviously to be a black girl or a black woman. Mm-hmm. But it's very profound. My father, I remember asking my father a number of years ago, I said, what's your favorite book? And he said, The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. And I remember being shocked by that. You know, a Colombian immigrant came to the United States when he was 13 and in 1961. And he points to this book and says, that's his favorite book of all time. That, I think, speaks to work again, which I think is something that I try to do, hopefully, so highly personal and specific, and yet can resonate so far beyond the maybe perceived demographic limitations, I mean, in that time period in particular with Toni Morrison, and see that it resonates with me, the son and the father and, you know, Colombian immigrant and people who come from a wide range of identities and backgrounds and experiences. So, yeah, I would say the Bluest Eye. There are other ones, but I think that's probably the one. Yeah.
Have you been to Colombia?
I have many, many, many times. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And have you seen the poetry scene?
You know what? Actually, interestingly enough, I've never gone there and checked out the poetry scene. And maybe that's because you go there for, I go there to be with family, and true, my family is not trying to go to the the open mic. You know, there are kind of like prescribed rhythms,
yeah,
of time with family.
Yes.
So, but I think that's something for my next trip to Colombia. I definitely will seek it out. There is the, you know, the Medellin International Poetry Festival. My father's and his family are actually from Medellin in Antioquia in Colombia. And that festival, I think, is probably at the top of my bucket list as a dream festival to visit someday. I've never performed in South America before, though I've traveled many times to South America. So
it would be coming around as well.
It would be coming full circle, right? Yeah. I mean, to be where my father was born and where the family has such deep and profound ties. So Yeah, I think that's my next trip to Colombia. That is, I need to check out the poetry scene, definitely.
Beautiful. Okay, so what about the poetry scene in New York?
Oh, yeah. Oof.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I'd love to get a taste of that.
Oh, my gosh.
Tell me, I mean, what is it?
No, it's incredible. I mean, it's something that I said. It was a friend's book launch actually last Saturday, and I was there just for one night. And I was saying to a lot of my friends who've come up through the poetry scene, you know, for a solid decade, for 10 years, I went to poetry probably about three nights a week for 10 years.
Three nights a week
for 10 years.
Wow.
And so every Monday I'd go to Bar 13. Every Thursday I'd go to the Bowery Poetry Club, and every Friday I'd go to the New Eurekan Poets Cafe. And just to think about, you know, the kind of people that I would just be standing alongside in the venue were incredible. You know what I mean? And these are poets now who've won National Book Awards and Pulitzers and gone on to be, you know, to be icons and legends, from, you know, Patricia Smith, Ross Gay, Taimba Jess, Rachel McKibbins, so many different people. You know, all these people, I think, to think about on any given night, that was just normal being out in New York. And I think that that kind of sharpens you in a particular kind of way that I don't think any other space could do in the same way. So I think I feel an immense amount of gratitude, and I think even now I'm still trying to sort of catch up to the just how miraculous it was that I was able to just reside in that space and believe it was normal.
When you started off doing performing in New York, was it as big as it is now, or has it grown?
Wow. I mean, yeah, I suppose it goes in waves. I mean, obviously the scene has evolved and changed, you know, and I think every literary scene kind of moves and evolves. And there are also things that we have now that did not exist when I was initially in the scene. I mean, for much of that decade, YouTube did not exist.
True.
There was not social media. So there were things that I think have influenced and shaped the aesthetics of how poetry exists in the more sort of popular consciousness that in that scene just was not a factor. And I think that, and I think in many ways that allowed the community to be a lot more cohesive, mm-hmm. in ways that I think that cohesion has been perhaps made more difficult, because people at home can sit home and on YouTube they feel like they can watch 2,000 poems if they want to.
Yeah, true.
or they can, from all over the world. In that era, if you wanted to watch poetry, you had to go see it, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And then when you did that enough, the people who saw you would say, do you have a new poem? So you were constantly generating new work to not feel like you were letting down everyone who saw you every week.
True.
So, so I think that really, you know, as we say, you know, in New York and in the States, you know, it helped me like cut my teeth. It helped me build my chops, you know, and not just doing that, but also, you know, I grew up performing at the Apollo and performing at other venues around New York. And so,
wow,
you know,
that's
impressive. New York is ruthless. You know what I mean? If you don't command a space, I mean, they will chew you up and spit you out. So you have to have a really clear sense about your purpose when you get up there every time, or you might literally be booed off the stage by 5,000 people at the Apollo, which I've experienced. You know
what
I mean?
Really?
I've won at the Apollo and gotten a standing ovation, and I've been booed off in 9 seconds. So I've experienced both extremes. And, you know, I think that's all part of that.
You know, I'd hate to focus on a negative experience, but can you elaborate?
Oh, no, it was a very positive experience. And the funny thing, too, which I think is also a really important lesson about being up in front of an audience, is the reason I got booed off actually had nothing to do with the poem that I had. I actually didn't even get to the poem. So it's kind of this iconic, sacred kind of, what would I call it? It's this sacred piece of a trunk called the Tree of Hope. At the Apollo, and when every person that walks on stage is supposed to rub the Tree of Hope for good luck, and also as a sign of respect to all the greats who've gone through the Apollo in its, you know, 90-year history. And I was so enthusiastic to get out there and get up in front of the mic that I walked past the Tree of Hope and forgot to rub it.
Oh my
God. And then I went back to rub it, And by that time, I had this feeling of just sort of turning my back, and the Apollo has all the things going up, and about 5,000 people sold out. And the booing was so loud that I could feel the boos going, hitting off the wall behind me. And it felt like somebody, like 1,000 hands slapping me on my back. That's
ricocheting
how loud,
off
that's,
the
how,
back.
That's how loud yeah. the sound was of the booing.
Wow.
And so, but it was a great experience. I mean, I cherish, you know, I think generally in my journey, I cherish the rejections. I cherish the spectacular failures. You know, I've had, you know, a lot of markers that people would think are, you know, people might point to and say are successes or things that gesture towards me moving in the right direction. But I mean, for every one of those instances, there are, I mean, literally hundreds of epic failures. And I think those are things that make me, you know, all those repetitions make me feel resilient and prepared on any stage I step into. I don't feel like any stage is too big because I've been in enough moments where I've been spectacular in succeeding or in my own mind or been present or commanded the room. And as many times or more, I've also spectacularly failed. So I think that gives me a permission to kind of let go of a lot of that.
It's honestly really good that you have an honest gauge.
Mm-hmm.
Of when you don't do well, you have people coming out and telling you you're not.
Oh yeah,
you're not hitting us the way you should be.
Oh yeah, in New York, they just you'll know quickly,
which is good. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, yeah,
because
yeah.
That's how you built your craft. Right?
It's a rare gift. Yeah, no, it's a really profound gift to get that feedback. I mean, so much of my artistic career, I'm very grateful for having not just random people, but also like a lot of mentors who had the thought and the generosity to tell me when things just were not working or to point me towards things that I needed to help build my tools, whether as a performer or as a writer.
Absolutely. Which takes me to my next question about mentorship.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on mentorship? And does it come in other forms other than like an individual? And I would also like to hear your thoughts on how would you go about seeking mentors?
Wow, that's a great question. I think mentorship is, I mean, when I think about whether, you know, it's like me trying to grow as a man or trying to grow as a writer, it is only made possible because of the generosity of mentors that have helped guide me and helped challenge me and hold me accountable and nurtured me and supported me through difficult moments. You know, I think for me, a lot of the mentorship that I experienced and then I think I hopefully paid back to younger generations as I got older and developed through the scene was when I first came into the scene. In 1999, I first went into the New Eurekan Poets Cafe and I was a 17-year-old high schooler and with very undeveloped tools and as a performer. And I had writers and poets from the older generation, which in poetry meant like 10 years older than me, who were 27. And they were very generous and sort of pulling me aside and supporting me, but also challenging me and also demanding more and also demanding that I, and they would hand me books and say, oh, go read this. You know, you should read this. Or, you know what, your poem ends there. Don't keep going. Or, you know what, when you got up there, why were you doing this? And then having me interrogate things that maybe I hadn't really reflected on that I just sort of had done impulsively. And so I think that's something that I always kept in my head. And then when I was 27 or I was 29, I would see some of those younger poets doing many of the things that I did, and I tried to pay that forward. So I think it was more, particularly in the New York scene, was more of an organic thing. There wasn't really a process or a protocol. It was more just, you know, we're here every week. We have a certain kind of candor and a certain kind of trust with each other that's built from the kind of cohesion of this, you know, or the sort of cohesive bond we have in this community. So it would just sort of happen organically. But again, I think that's changed in some ways. Like even what you're doing now is really incredible. You know, I've heard that there's the attendance has been kind of dropping in a lot of the U.S. at poetry events. And so that becomes more difficult. I'm a strong proponent of believing that for the kind of intensive mentorship that's required, an actual physical space where you are present with each other and it can happen in some kind of organic format, that for me feels like the most profound way that it can happen. But the world that we live in is that's becoming more difficult. I know there are virtual ways that can happen. When I 2 years ago when I graduated from my MFA program, I had supervisors, faculty members who I corresponded with via, we would write letters to each other, and that was a really profound, you know, means of mentorship. But yeah, I don't know. I think there is something really powerful about having a physical space, a hub that you and other writers say, we have this general agreement that as long as, you know, my sister is not getting married, or I'm not working overtime, I'll be here every Monday, or I'll be here on the third Thursday of every month. Yes. And we come here, and the agreement is we support each other and we challenge each other. And for those who've been around longer or those who are just stepping in, we're going to help each other. And we're going to build a kind of lineage here that we guard very with a lot of passion and a lot of purpose and a lot of pride. And so I think, I don't know, when I think of mentorship, I mean, mentorship is everything. It's everything. It's to me, it's one of the most generous expressions of legacy and lineage. Mm-hmm. Is to say, I was 17 and the elders in that scene helped guide me. And now I'm seen as an elder in a way in this community. And so now I try to pay that forward with people who are just walking into this space. You know, cotton mouthed and wide eyed like I did in 1999 in the Eureka Poets Cafe.
Beautiful. Man, you hit the nail on the head, in my opinion, about the mentorship question. It really does take a space.
Yes, yes.
Building that space. Yes. It's not easy.
No, it's not. It's not.
Getting a united front
from
an audience and poets and people to agree that this is going to happen every whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
And to be there every single time.
Yeah.
Who is setting up these events?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, to be honest, a lot of the greatest mentors and leaders and literary citizens in the New York scene who were exceptionally gifted and selfless curators of the scene. I'll just say in New York City, Mahogany L. Brown is one of those people. I think the longest standing slam mistress of the Friday Night Poetry Slam, which is the biggest, most legendary poetry slam at the New Eurekan. Jean Ann Verlee is another one who was the main curator for many years at Urbana at the Bowery Poetry Club. Rachel McKibbins, back when it was Louder Arts, but at Bar 13, which was another venue in New York City. Lynn Prokop is another person at Bar 13. There have been names like that. It's overwhelmingly been women. It's overwhelmingly been women of color. It's in many cases been Black women. So I think, in New York City, I'm grateful to call all those names, all those people friends, and people that I hold very dear. But yeah, I think a lot of that really selfless and often thankless work made possible these vibrant communities that sprung up. Of course, they had their, you know, there were complexities and there was, you know, there were positives and negatives. It's difficult to hold together a community, of course, and it's a lot of writers. So, you know, but I think they made possible these different avenues of mentorship that otherwise, without their love and their generosity and their leadership, that stuff is not possible. It's so difficult, as you're saying, to be able to curate a space where people feel permission and also feel energized about locking into their calendar and pen to be there at this time and speak on the open mic or listen.
And then as a curator, you have the other issue of how am I going to reach a mass audience that will come and experience this poetry?
Yeah. Yeah,
it's a constant struggle.
Yeah,
let me just say that.
Yeah.
All right, I think we are good.
Thank you so much, Jamil. What a joy to chat with you. I'm already really moved by kind of the generosity and the passion of who you are and what you're doing, and I can't wait for Saturday evening to just really get a real sense of what Poetryhood is all about. It's been great. Awesome. I'm cheering for you. Cool. Thank you, Jamil. I appreciate you.
Cheers.